I had an experience this week that I don't usually have. One of the fellows in the first Sunday school hour is a retired minister and is now living in retirement at Lakewood Manor, and invited me to come out there and speak to a group of ministers who meet once a month for breakfast and some kind of a presentation. And one of the things he invited me to do was to show appreciation to them for what they had done and to encourage them in their retirement years. And not realizing that with Barbara retiring right now, I've already been sort of thinking about how you make a transition of that sort. One of the things that I did was I brought in with me a little thing that I have in my archives. My grandfather put this together back in the 50s, and an uncle of mine in the late 70s compiled it into a little booklet like this. It's called I Remember When. He was born in 1891, and so his childhood went from roughly 1890 to 1905. And he talks about what it was like growing up back there. And so I read to them from Section 9 on religious services. Preaching was usually one Sunday of each month, if the weather permitted. The preacher lived in another community normally, and came to the church Saturday morning riding horseback and having saddle pockets in which he carried his Bible and maybe a clean shirt. He preached on Saturday morning at 11 a.m. This was followed by the monthly business meeting of the church. At an early date, there was no Saturday night service, but later they became common. So on Saturday, the preacher, after service, went home with some family, stayed until Sunday morning, and then went to the church again and preached on Sunday morning after. Having dinner with another family, he would depart for the month, when again the same routine was followed. The pay the preacher usually received was $5 per visit, or $60 per year. There was no ministerial relief, no retirement, no other enticements to get the preacher to keep on preaching. It was usual for them to ride 20 to 25 miles each way for the services. They must have preached because they wanted to. I took with me a second book, which I don't have now because I gave it to a friend of mine out of the first hour. Her husband was homesick, and he comes from up in that area, so I thought he might like to look at it. It's called Pioneer Preachers in Primitive Tennessee. And in that book are vignettes, sometimes a page, sometimes four or five pages, talking about preachers in the time period from the early 1700s through about 1900. And this fellow simply compiled reports on this and that preacher, put them all in alphabetical order about 20 years later. So around 1915 to 1918, he compiled this into the book that I have, that I rescued from my dad's house. There's a story in there about the preacher who was responsible for starting the church that nurtured me when I was growing up in my childhood and high school years. And he had other stories along. There was a story about a fellow by the name of D.F. Manley, which is not untypical. You saw this kind of pattern over and over again. It said he had preached in 22 or 23 different churches, typically four at a time. So what I just described, he would go to one church once a month and then a different church once a month and a different church once a month on a circuit of some kind. And it said that over the course of his time, and that was as of 1897 when he was 57 years old, he had preached 140 revival services. He had seen 3,000 conversions and had baptized 2,500 people. So if you go to the river baptism today, there's a legacy back there that's pretty impressive. If you want to know why there's so many Baptists in Tennessee, it's the hard work of people like that set a foundation. And it was interesting to be in that place. Now, this morning we are coming back to 1 Corinthians 13 as sort of the basis for where we're doing, where we're working. We're not going to stay there very long, but in one of the early sets of verses, I think it's verse 2 to 4 or verse 4 to 6, something like that, there's this quick list of love is these things and love is not those things. And 15 of those, and I've got those listed up here. We've looked through those once, and now we're coming back through a second pass. And in this pass, what we're doing is looking at actions during Jesus' life that illustrated one or another of these. And this morning, partly because we've used a little bit more time for field trips and stuff like that, what I propose to do is briefly talk about the first two of 6, 7, and 8, and then spend a little bit more time on number 8. So, never acts unseemly or never acts unbecomingly, never seeks its own, never claims its rights, and then finally, number 8, not easily provoked. And I'd like you to look at those three with me. The first of these, I'd like you to look at Luke chapter 4 for an illustration of this. These illustrations are suggested by T.W. Hunt, and they're interesting. This is one I'd like to take a little longer with. It's fun if I do, but I'll try not to do that. Luke chapter 4, and if you will take a look in verse 16, let me set the context for you. He came to Nazareth. Nazareth was where he had grown up. This is Jesus. And he went into the synagogue on the Sabbath day, as was his custom. He stood up to read, and they handed him the scroll of the prophet Isaiah. And then the rest of that verse and the next verse, it quotes what he read. Verse 20, he rolled up the scroll and gave it back to the assistant and sat down. All the eyes of the people in the synagogue were fixed on him, and he began to speak. Verse 21 gives you the sermon. In my translation, it's about 12 or 13 words. What's his sermon? What the prophet Isaiah said has been fulfilled and is being fulfilled in your hearing, even this morning. Verse 22 gives part of the reaction of the crowd. What does it say? They spoke well. Mine says he won the approval of all. And then it goes on and says a little bit more. What does it say? They were amazed. Mine says they were astonished. At what? At the words that came out of his mouth. Mine says the gracious words that came from his lips. Now, as you continue the rest of the verse, there is another reaction that they're having. And that reaction is, this was so impressive, but wait a minute, we know who this guy is. Where did all this come from? They said, this is Joseph's son, surely. And Jesus' reply is very interesting, and the impact of it goes through verse 27. He said to them, no doubt you will quote to me the saying, physician, heal yourself, and tell me, we've heard all that happened in Capernaum, why don't you do the same here in your own hometown? What are they looking for?
Miracle.
Mm-hmm. They're hearing the words. They're impressed as can be with that, but they're saying, wait a minute, we know this guy. And how can all this be coming from him? We hear about him doing miracles elsewhere. Why don't you impress us too? Why don't you do a miracle? Jesus' response goes on, verse 24, I tell you, no prophet is ever accepted in his hometown or in his own country. And he goes on in verse 25, 26, and 27 to say, back when Elijah was here, there were people in trouble from the famine that occurred all over the place in Israel. But the prophet Elijah didn't go to anybody in Israel. He went outside to a widow from another country. And then the prophet Elisha, who was immediately after that, there were people with leprosy all over the place in Israel. Not one of those was cured. The man who was cured was from Syria. What's he said to them? Miracles aren't going to impress you. It doesn't matter what I do, you're going to want more, you're going to want more, you're going to want more. Verse 28, when they heard this, everyone in the synagogue had an emotional reaction. What's the word that's used there?
Furious.
Furious. Yeah. Says they were filled with rage. Mine says simply they were enraged. What did they do? A mob formed. They grabbed Jesus. And where did they take him? To a cliff, the edge of a cliff. The city was built up on a high hill. And what are they going to do? Throw him off. Now, let's pause for a second right there. Don't go any further.
How much power did Jesus have?
Plenty.
Absolutely. What could he have done?
Go back to the westerns that you may have watched in your childhood. Rub them out. Right? He could have simply taken them out. What else could he have done? Could have pled for his life. Oh, please don't throw me over the cliff. Or, and he could have pointed his finger at him and yelled at him. What does he do? This is strange until you start to see what he's doing. Verse 30. And that's the focus verse for this one. Luke 4:30. And you have to see our context coming into that. What did he do? In the first hour, it was pointed out by somebody I respect very much. He actually did the miracle that they'd asked him to do. And they didn't recognize it for what it was. How could he have acted? He could have rebuked them. He could have punished them. He could have acted in all kinds of ways. How did he act? Now, I want to try if I can to put together what I've learned from some of my educational friends to call a meta message. I want to pick up something from here, pick up something from here, and then pick up something from here and have you walk out this morning seeing a package that connects some of these together. What did he do? He simply said, this situation isn't healthy for me or for them. We're going to just stop this right now, and I'm going to be someplace else. It doesn't really explain. It just says he passed through them. How do you pass through a mob that has you? That's the miracle that I think they asked for but didn't recognize when it came. Okay? Now, let's move to the next one. Does not act unbecomingly, the first one. My translation says, never seeks its own. Never seeks its own. But I think at least one translation, or at least we moved to this as we talked about this, doesn't claim its rights. Does that echo from the sermon this morning? Remember what Dr. Collins said at one point? What did he say? If you're going to let go of anger, frustration, there's going to have to come a moment where you say something. What do you say? I give up my right to hurt you. Keep going. Just because you hurt me. I'm going to break the cycle of violence. That's our language for our day. Mm-hmm. Doesn't claim its rights. I remember a very long time ago now, it seems like. I had the opportunity, Barbara and I did, to go on a mission trip to Africa. The person who was leading that trip called us into a room and said, I need to work with you. I need to show you two lists. One list is stuff you need to take with you. One list is stuff that you need to leave behind. Now, if you were getting ready to make a trip to Africa, what do you think would be on the first list? Sunscreen.
Mosquito repellent.
Right. Comfortable shoes. Right. And the stuff to leave behind?
Anything away from there.
Okay. Maybe some of your electronic toys. Maybe some of the frilly stuff that's... the stuff that's really not practical for that kind of... That's what you expect to be on the two lists, right? Well, we eventually got lists like that, but that turned out not to be the list for that day. The list of stuff to take with us was a list of attitudes. Take with you a smile. Take with you an anticipation of God doing great things and you being able to witness it, and maybe some of those things being done through you. And I don't remember the others on the list, but I remember the tenor of that list. Now, with that, what do you think's on the other list? I'll tell you the big one that was behind on that list. Leave your rights at home. Don't claim your rights. Let them go. Because the moment you start claiming your rights, you're going to put a barrier between you and the people you're trying to work with and get to know and interact with. Leave the claiming of rights at home. That's what this one's talking about. That's what this one's talking about. Jesus has a right to claim things, but he does not do that. John 15 is where we're going to go. And once we get there, we're there for the rest of the day, pretty much. Because both of these, number 7 and number 8, are illustrated out of this chapter. At the first of chapter 6, if you'll take a look down at verse 5, verse 6, verse 7, skim it real quickly, you'll probably recognize what this story is. What's the story? Chapter 6. John chapter 6. Did I say 15? I'm sorry. John chapter 6. John chapter 6. I misspoke. Please forgive me. Give up your right to criticize. The front of chapter 6. The front of chapter 6. What's the story? Feeding the 5,000. What I want to bring your attention to is not the story of the miracle of feeding the 5,000. I want you to look at the reaction of the crowd. Look at the reaction of the crowd. Verse 14 begins, seeing the sign that he had done, the people said, what they said? This is indeed the prophet who was going to come into the world. Now, 15, verse 15, is the focus verse for us here. And before you start reading that, I want you to look at the English, the structure of that sentence. This is John 6, 15. I want to know if yours is structured the same as mine. The word Jesus, a comma, a long phrase, a comma, and the rest of the thing. Okay? I want you to look at what's between the commas first. Because this is still the reaction of the crowd and Jesus realizing, okay, they had this much of a reaction. This is what they're beginning to do. This is what they are about to do. Jesus, comma, having realized that, what does that phrase say? What were the people about to do? Be careful. There's two phrases there. You left out one. Take him by force, my translation says, and make him king. How do you take somebody by force and make them king? Does this even make sense? It clearly didn't make sense to Jesus because he put a stop to it very quickly. Was he king? Did he have a right to be king?
Yes.
But not this way. Jesus becomes king by the surrender of an individual heart. Jesus has not become king by a whole bunch of people putting him on a political, earthly throne. He wasn't seeking what was his by right. He was seeking instead God's will. Jesus, seeing that they were about to come and take him by force and make him king, what's the word after the comma?
Withdrew.
Mine says fled. In the first hour, there was a fellow sitting over on the right-hand side who I believe is a colonel in the Army. He's currently in a reserve unit, but he has had active duty service, and I think his son is in Germany now, I think, maybe. And he made the observation, there's a difference between fleeing and withdrawing. Wasn't that a great line? And here's what he said. When you're fleeing, you're withdrawing with a sense of urgency. Wasn't that nice? You're withdrawing with a sense of urgency. Okay? Now, two times now, Jesus has been part of a crowd, and the crowd is about to do something to him by force. One of them is to destroy him. What's the second one? To make him an earthly kind of king. And what's his reaction to both moments? To withdraw. Separate from that situation. Right? Okay. Remember there's a meta message that's coming? Keep your eye on that. There's one when you see all three of these, you see something a little bit bigger than the individual. Chuck, I think I saw your hand or else you were stretching it.
You know, when you think of fleeing, as opposed to withdrawal,
clean sort of makes me think more of a fear.
Yeah, and that's the part I don't like. It also could mean he is withdrawing, but they're still following him, trying to keep him there. And you know, I don't know how to interpret the word. I just thought it was funny that I offered the word and got this response back. I thought that was an interesting way of looking at it. But in both cases, in one case, they want to do something that they would have seen as negative. And Jesus does not retaliate to that. He simply withdraws. In the second case, they want to do something that from their standpoint would look like something positive. But Jesus recognizes it for what it is, trying to give him worldly power when he has no interest in that. What he wants is to reign over my heart and to reign over your heart, and therefore in our community to reign over collectively our hearts. And so once again, he withdraws. Withdraws is probably the better verb there. Okay, well, that's number two. Let's look at number three. This is the only one in this whole list in 1 Corinthians 13 that is qualified. What does it say?
Not easily.
Easily provoked. Not easily provoked. I would be prepared to argue that the first two cases represent provocation. Would you agree? Would you agree? So this one is sort of a, let's look at those two and one more and see what we can learn from. So, we're still in here. We're still in the same chapter. And I want to just skip through here and pick up a couple of verses for you to see. Take a look at verse 28. The people said to him, "What must we do if we are to carry out God's work?" If you want to have the Bible say, "This is God's will for my life," or "This is God's will for you," this is one of the places you ought to look. It seldom gets quite as clear as it is in this verse. They said to him, "What must we do if we're to carry out God's work?" Verse 29, Jesus gave them this answer. This is carrying out God's work. What is it? You must believe in the one that he said. And once again, you'll notice, what sign will you yourself do, the sight of which will make us believe in you? It's almost as if they're saying, well, what you've done so far didn't work. Can you do something else? Okay. And he goes on and talks about this a little bit. And in his responses, they start to get irritated at it. Take a look at verse 41. I'm not looking at the details yet. Just pick up a couple of things. The Jews were complaining to each other about him, the Jewish leaders, because he had said a certain thing. And they were saying once again, "This is Jesus, son of Joseph. We know his father. We know his mother. Who is this person saying these things?" Verse 52, they started arguing among themselves. Verse 59, the sentence in verse 59 looks back at all these things and says, this is all the stuff that he taught in the synagogue at Capernaum. Verse 60, after hearing it, many of his followers said, "This is intolerable language. How could anybody accept it?" Jesus was aware that his followers were complaining about it, and he said, "Does this disturb you?" And he goes on, verse 64, to say, "There's some of you who do not believe." But Jesus knew from the onset who did not believe and who was to betray him. Verse 66, after this, many of his disciples went away and accompanied him no more. Now we're almost to the focal point. We're almost to the focal point. I think you'll see how this develops. Verse 67, Jesus then turned to the 12 and said to them, "What about you? Are you going to go away as well?" I want you to understand that question in the context of people who had been close to him. His disciples were not just the 12. There was a large company of them. And many of them were now going away. And he turns to the 12 and he says, "Are you going to go away too?" Now this is reported. This same moment is reported in Matthew and a couple of other places. And I think in one of the other Gospels it says that Peter is the one who says this. Here it just reports the statement. What did the disciples say? Verse 68. "Where shall we go? Where can we go? You're the one with the words of life. We have come to know that you are the Messiah, the Holy One of God." And Jesus replied to them, "Did I not choose the 12 of you? Yet one of you is a devil." By this he meant Judas, son of Simon Iscariot, since this was the man, one of the 12, who was to betray him. Now, let me see now if I can put all three of these things together. A mob comes up and they're going to try to throw him off a cliff top. Because they're from his hometown, they think they know who he is, and therefore they think he's committing blasphemy. And what does he do?
withdraws almost miraculously. He feeds the 5,000. The people say, okay, this is going to be our political king. This is going to be our earthly king, and try to take him by force and make him king. What does he do? He withdraws. Now you're looking at his inner circle, the 12 disciples, and one of them he knows is going to betray him. Why doesn't he withdraw from that guy?
Because he was sent there to
steal. Louder.
Because he was sent to earth to die on the cross and to be betrayed by people.
One reason is, this is God's plan. There needs to be somebody to betray him. He said at one point,
these things need to happen, but woe betide the one by whom it happens. So one explanation, which I do not say is wrong, was there was a role for Judas to play in betraying him. But I don't think that tells the whole story. Why didn't he withdraw from Judas? Now, what's the larger point I'm making? The point I'm making is sometimes he withdraws from conflict. Sometimes he stays in conflict. What's guiding him as he does this? Yeah, that's easy. If you look at that, then everything becomes utilitarian. And I think I'm not saying that's wrong. I think that's right. But I think there's something deeper here. Yes, ma'am?
The situation is with a large crowd of people who are not as close to him. The third situation is his disciples. It's your family, it's your friend, it's those who know him best. And so the response from him, you're less inclined to be provoked with someone that you're close to. You're more inclined to make that forgiveness or make that allowance than you might be with someone at a higher level.
I think you're absolutely right, but I think the gospel record is even more interesting. There is a long interaction that Jesus has with the Jewish leaders, who he already knows are out to kill him, and all they want is for him to say the wrong thing and they'll have their grounds. And he's got, seems like, two chapters of interaction with these people. Why didn't he withdraw from them? I think that's right, but I think there's something bigger than that. If you go through his life, sometimes in moments like this, he withdraws, and sometimes he doesn't. He stays engaged. What's making the difference? That's what I'm trying to get at.
Smaller groups?
The attitude of a small group. It's more, you want me, we don't have anywhere to go.
Yeah. Let me offer this and see how you can make this fit with what Travis has said, because what Travis has said is almost exactly where I end up going on this moment. Why does he stay in contact with Judas? Because he sees possibility in Judas that Judas doesn't see in himself. Why does he stay engaged with those Jewish leaders? He knows how it's going to come out, but at the end of the day, he wants to have done everything he can to give them the chance to turn away from him. Everything he can to keep engaged. What makes the difference, I think, is the size of the crowd. When there's that many, you can't interact. But when it's a smaller number, how small does that number have to be? Maybe less than 20, maybe 15 or 10. Certainly one or two would work. There's that number of people. If he's got an engagement with them, he doesn't seem to cut those things off. Even if he doesn't know them well, he seems to engage in the dialogue and stay with it as long as that person will stay with him. If you look at the end of Jesus' life, around the time of the arrest and the crucifixion, two of his disciples were portrayed as doing things that were betrayal. Judas and Peter. Right? And when the crucifixion is over, Peter is restored. How? By repentance. Could Judas have been restored as well? My argument is, I think so. That he was not that Jesus rejected him. It was that Judas closed the door. Not easily provoked means something simple. It means you keep a connection of dialogue open when that connection has a personal touch to it. And you keep it open in the hopes of having some restoration of relationship. And that's what Jesus models. For us, we're not Jesus, and we got to find another path through this that's true to what he's given us an example and still works with our community. And that's where I think what Travis talked about this morning is powerful. What happens when somebody's got you mad? What happens when a situation has you angry and upset and provoked? What do you do then? What did he say? Do you remember his points this morning? He wrote them down on a piece of paper for us in our hour just in case we were forgetful. I don't know if he trusts you all to be less forgetful. Maybe he gave you a piece of paper too. All right? What does he say? He starts to talk about, be aware of the consequences in your own life of letting that kind of anger come. Be aware of the opportunities you may miss if you focus on the anger and don't focus on the others. The opportunities and possibilities, both for things in your life and the things of others' lives. And at that point, I start thinking about what it's been like the last 2 years as I've begun to have a leadership responsibility where I work. And all of a sudden, I'm responsible for trying to work with a whole bunch of people that all have their own way of doing things. One of the things I've noticed is that every once in a while, somebody gets mad about something. And they come to somebody else in our group, and they express that anger and their frustration. And at that moment, it seems to me, it's like a fork in the road. There's two things that can happen. And the response of that person is the key. If that person responds by saying, wait a minute, have you thought about what it is you're really angry about? I think that was point one on the list that they said to make. Have you thought about why have you tried to articulate exactly what it is you're angry about? Have you begun to look at what you've contributed to this? That's hard to do. And I forget what the fourth point is, but if you respond that way, you start to get people to look from the short term to the long term, and sometimes that can turn anger into introspection, into adjustments. But what happens if the response is, oh yeah, man, I'd be angry about that too? Which seems to happen regularly where I work. We had something magnificent happen in the 8 o'clock hour today. And it illustrated perfectly what I was trying to say. And I didn't realize until the first hour was over I would have commented on it. We had finished a choral piece. And the pastor walked up to the podium and turned on his microphone. At which point the speakers screamed at us. I mean, it was painful to the ears. You were there. You guys were there. Some of you heard that. It was painful. What was happening? Feedback on the amplification system. Turned out later, I watched him work with the sound people. He had it turned up too high. And so what happens was, it puts the sound through the speakers. Now it picks up that sound and amplifies it again. And you get this amplification feedback and everything goes nuts. I get angry about something. I express my anger to somebody else. And say, oh, I would be angry about that. What happened? Now you got two people angry and they're both angrier than either one would have been alone. And they sit there and toss it back and forth. And each time they toss it back and forth, they get angry and angry and angry. And sometimes I step into it a day later, and I suddenly got these two people that are furious. And I find myself saying, wait a minute. Have you stopped to think about what is it you're really angry about? Why are you angry at them? What have you contributed? The list that he just talked about. And sometimes I can pull it back. But more often than not, it gets really tough. When you get provoked, do you have a built-in amplification system that raises that to a point where all kinds of things are going to go worse? Or do you have some kind of system in place that helps you deal with anger, deal with frustration? And what Jesus had as one of his tools was to take a step away from the situation. And the other tool was to engage, but engage with a set of questions that deflected the anger and began to move towards an analysis, a spiritual analysis of what the truth was behind those situations. Now, each time, it's always a little different. You have to lay these things out and you'll begin to see each one was a little different. Each one was unique and he handled it that way. But if you watch the big principles, it was Jesus never provided feedback into the amplification. That's why I think the size of the group had something to do with that. Now, what does that teach us? I don't know. Except what Travis talked about this morning was extremely important. And we can help others deal with that, and we can keep those points to help ourselves. And maybe that's enough for one day. Let's have a word of prayer as we go. Now, Father, you taught us in the life of your Son what it looks like to act in right ways, to give up the rights that we may have, and to act without being provoked. Teach us that this is something you want us to develop as well. And We pray that the spirit that you've put inside of us will help work us through the process of learning how to do this. Help us keep our eye on the opportunities you have for service and for influence for you that are thwarted or blocked if we let anger and provocation take rule in our hearts. Help us let your spirit take rule in our hearts. We ask in Jesus' name. Amen.